seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Many people were left without homes, and the cyclone moved inland to the city of Pemba, where it destroyed also homes. Many people left their homes and were driven away from their homes on Sunday night.
That's VOA's Charles Manguero reporting from Maputo on Cyclone Chido and the damage it left in Mozambique. Details coming up also. A Nigerian international relations expert says it may be difficult to convince three West African countries from leaving ECOWAS. And Mali's army says it has captured a top leader in the Sahel branch of the Islamic State group. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. An overnight curfew goes into force today as authorities try to stabilize Mayotte in the aftermath of Cyclone Chido, the most intense storm to hit the French Indian Ocean archipelago in 90 years. The French military said it is sending 4 to 5 planes a day with up to 50 tons of assistance, including food, water, and medicine. According to an Associated Press report, hundreds of military personnel have arrived in Mayotte since the weekend. The official death toll from Saturday's cyclone rose to 22, with more than 1,400 people injured, including 48 critically, according to the latest report from Mayotte Hospital, quoted by the mayor of the capital, Mamadou Zou. However, authorities fear hundreds and possibly thousands of people have died. French President Emmanuel Macron has pledged to visit Mayotte soon and to declare a national mourning period. Cyclone Chido then moved into Mozambique, leaving at least 15 people dead in Mozambique's three northern provinces. A short time ago, I spoke with reporter Charles Manguero in the capital Maputo about the storm damage.
Yes, the cyclone made its landfall in the province of Cabo Delgado on Sunday, particularly in the district of Mekufi, where it destroyed several homes and killed as many as close to 40 people, according to preliminary reports. The government is still compiling the data now. Many people were left without homes, and the cyclone moved inland to the city of Pemba, where it destroyed also homes. Many people left their homes and were driven away from their homes on Sunday night. Right now, the government is compiling the data, and they are trying to find out what are the needs of the people so far. But many schools, we are told, they have been destroyed, including electricity pylons, and communication also has been interrupted.
The brunt of Cyclone Chido actually hit Mayotte very, very severely. But like you are saying, Mozambique was also a victim of the cyclone. So what is the government doing right now in Mozambique to alleviate the situation over there?
The government now is compiling the data of what has been happening, because the cyclone really made some massive damage, especially in the province of Cabo Delgado, where close to 30,000 homes were destroyed. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees is saying that it is trying to cater to supply some food relief, because many people were left without nothing to eat. Some people have got no homes to sleep. They have nowhere to stay, and everything they had was destroyed. What is complicating the things now, according to the government authorities in Mozambique, is many roads were rendered impassable into the province of Cabo. So it's difficult to get to where the people are. The people now need support. Many people were displaced from their homes because their homes were blown off by the cyclone. So tomorrow the government is sending in a team that will be working close to the people and try to give them assistance. There are three provinces that were hit, namely Cabo Delgado, Nampula, and the other province of Niassa. In all these provinces, people were left without homes. So they are trying to figure out how many, but so far they are talking of close to 150,000 people who need relief aid as an emergency situation.
That's VOA's Charles Manguero. He talked to me from Mozambique's capital, Maputo. In A Nigerian international relations expert says it may be difficult to convince three West African countries from leaving ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. ECOWAS's leaders on Sunday gave Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger 6 months to reconsider their decision to quit the bloc. The three are led by military governments. The countries said their decision is irreversible and have formed a new body known as the Alliance of Sahel States. David Awarowo is a professor of international relations and strategic studies at the University of Lagos. He is also the head of the university's Department of History and Strategic Studies. Awarowo tells reporter Mike Mbonye the three Sahel countries may face serious challenges fighting insurgencies without the assistance of other ECOWAS states.
It's a good decision. They are trying to keep to the treaty, the ECOWAS revised treaty, which provides that in Article 91, that if a country submits a request to leave, it has a year. And so in January 2025, it will be 1 year after the request to leave was submitted. So they are trying to keep to the provisions of the ECOWAS treaty, the revised treaty. At the same time, still leaving the window open for the possibility of these countries to come in, not to leave. Because of the realization that it's a mistake, that these countries are opting to leave, it will not benefit them. It will also benefit the other ECOWAS members. So it's a clever way of keeping to the provisions of the ECOWAS treaty, while at the same time seeking to see ways of persuading these countries to remain within the bloc. So it's a fantastic move by ECOWAS leaders to keep the bloc at the level that it should be, which will include, mean that these three countries will be part of, ECOWAS ultimately, if what they seek to achieve succeeds.
ECOWAS leaders have mandated the presidents of Senegal and Togo to mediate on their behalf to talk to the three countries, namely Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, to reconsider their decision. Do you think the presidents of Senegal and Togo or their mediation will yield any fruit?
I doubt. They have been on this for some time. They are not just starting the process of trying to get these countries to dissuade them from their decision to leave. But those countries have come to say their decision to leave is they can't change it. It's irreversible. That's the language they have used. I doubt if these countries would change their mind. But it's good that, the dialogue, the diplomacy continues. Who knows? Something might just happen that might make them change their minds. Mind you, they've also formed what they call the Alliance of Sahel States, ASS, Alliance de l'État du Sahel, which they have formed to, keep their own cooperation separate from ECOWAS. So, well, there's no harm in trying. That's how I see it. But I doubt whether the efforts of these two countries, Togo and Senegal, to try to get these leaders to remain within the ECOWAS bloc, I doubt if it will yield fruit.
Sir, if eventually the Alliance of Sahel States is formed, if eventually these three countries leave ECOWAS, what are their chances of survival, given the fact that most of the jihadist movements, most of the fighting in the sub-region is affecting these countries?
Yeah, the impact on them will be negative. It will affect them negatively more than the other 12 states that make up ECO, that will be left if these countries leave. These are very poor countries. They are among the poorest countries in the world. And their trade relations and other economic activities with other ECOWAS countries has contributed to their prosperity. And so leaving will make them a lot poorer than they are currently. The second level is that we know how terrorists operate. They operate in one country, run to another. Cooperation among ECOWAS countries has been positive in trying to check the jihadists that are operating in the Sahel. Now, cutting off from the rest of ECOWAS will also hurt them, because it will mean that, those activities they used to have with the other ECOWAS countries, intelligence sharing, cooperation to tackle the jihadists will reduce. And that would make them more vulnerable to attack from the terrorists. So anyhow one looks at it, is a mistake. It will hurt them. It will hurt the other ECOWAS states, but it will hurt them more. One final thing is this. These countries, they are in between other countries within ECOWAS. So the free movement of persons and goods will be affected. The ECOWAS is happy that for now, these three countries have said they will leave their borders open to the other 12, you know, ECOWAS member states so that goods and persons can move freely, but hoping that they won't change their mind somewhere along the line. So it's a bad move. Unfortunately, they are pushing ahead with their decision to exit ECOWAS, which will not pay them, and which will not pay the other 12 member states of ECOWAS should these countries leave.
That was David Aworawo, a Nigerian international relations expert. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Lagos. Mali's army says it has captured a top leader in the Sahel branch of the Islamic State group and killed several fighters in an operation Sunday in the east of the country. The Malian army says the units of Tagadiet in the eastern Manaka region had on Sunday captured Ahmad Agdita, a top leader of the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. The French news agency AFP reported that the army alleges Dita was responsible for a large number of violations and abuses of all kinds against innocent civilians. It also said his group sponsored attacks against the Malian armed forces. The army says Sunday's operation also neutralized several fighters and recovered military equipment. The West African state has battled several militant groups since 2012. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs, and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yehia Suhib in Washington. A Ugandan International Crimes Division court has ordered the Ugandan government to pay reparations to war crimes victims affected by atrocities committed by former Lord's Resistance Army Commander Thomas Kowelo. Halima Atumani in Kampala spoke to legislators from northern Uganda who fault a delayed process for helping victims.
A Ugandan court on Monday ordered government officials to pay victims reparations for war crimes committed by former Lord's Resistance Army or LRA rebel commander Thomas Kowelo. The judges argue the order is based on both international and domestic law, considering Kowelo, 50, has no funds. Kowelo was captured in 2009 in the Democratic Republic of Congo and held in detention until a court found him guilty in August of murder, kidnap with intent to murder, pillaging, cruel treatment, torture, rape, and crimes against humanity. He was sentenced to 40 years in prison in October. The LRA, founded in 1986 by Joseph Kony, led a more than 20-year insurgency against the Ugandan government and is accused of carrying out multiple massacres. Kony remains at large. Justice Duncan Gaswaga said the court declaration is not based on fault or vicarious liability, but on principles of collective responsibility.
Atrocities committed on a scale warranting transitional justice is considered a manifestation of a failure on the part of government that triggers the responsibility for the state to pay reparations to the victims.
Transitional justice is a set of policies or mechanisms to address the aftermath of large-scale human rights abuses and sometimes political instability. The Office of the Ugandan Attorney General, the government's representative, reiterated its argument that the government is not liable to compensate for crimes committed by private actors and that reparations sought are matters of policy. Speaking to VOA by phone, Silas Agon, a lawmaker from northern Uganda, says the draft Transitional Justice Bill has been in the offing since 2019, but has not been brought before Parliament for consideration. He says the bill would address accountability, reparations, institutional reforms, and enable truth-telling. Agon faults the delayed justice on a number of weaknesses.
There is already institutional weakness, legislative weakness, oversight weakness, given the kind of situation that we have in the country, the kind of polarization that the country went through, the kind of human and other injustices that occurred in society, the social unrest, we needed a strong law. And we needed the Transitional Justice Bill to be passed in law as soon as possible.
The court declarations include $2,700 to be paid to families of each deceased person, $1,000 to those who suffered physical injuries, $950 for each victim household of property loss, and $1,350 for victims of gender-based violence such as rape, forced marriage, forced labor, and other physical abuse. Lawmaker Betty Ochan says they have been pushing for this bill for a year and fears they are running out of time since the current parliament ends in 2026, and passing the Transitional Justice Bill doesn't seem to be a priority.
We need the bill to be worked on to come to an act of parliament in order for our victims also to have, you know, fair compensation. You know, this parliament is also a difficult one. Instead of prioritizing things which are really for the people, sometimes we prioritize things which are for the president. So we will continue to push.
The court's judges noted their inability to enforce orders in this matter, stating that the establishment of a trust fund for victims, provisions for an annual budget for victims, and a draft implementation plan to serve the victim all hinge on parliament. Halima Athmani, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
With the spread of false information on social media, journalists in Mozambique are on the front line in the fight against mis- and disinformation. Amaralis Gule has the report from Maputo.
Here in the Evidences newsroom in Maputo, Mozambique, Reginaldo Chambul and his team are working to set the record strength in a bid to combat misinformation and disinformation. He and his colleague Nelson Mukanzi say they co-founded the print and digital news outlet 4 years ago because many other organizations were not fact-checking or using data and analysis in their reporting. Chambuli says their audience quickly took off.
The Evidencias newspaper may have gained greater visibility, greater prominence in such a short space of time because of the way we approach journalism itself. We once had a page where we fact-checked the main news stories circulating on social media.
This year, Chambuli reported on why Yusufu Momadi, the leader of RENAMO, Mozambique's main opposition party, had not been seen in public in the first week during the presidential campaign. Evidences began investigating a photo on the candidate's Facebook page that appeared to suggest that Momad was working in a mission abroad.
We already had contact with some image verification tools. We took the image and put it into the software and found that the image had been published on the same page in 2019. That was the change of narrative that could have misinformed the public.
With the spread of false information on social media, the Media Institute of Southern Africa, or MISA, Mozambique's journalist Armando Nyantumbu, says that investing in technology is needed on newsrooms to train journalists on how to combat mis- and disinformation.
Thanks to technology, we have greater access to information, and we are able to participate more and more in governance issues, for example, which was difficult 30 years ago. What is happening is that, alongside these advantages, there are disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is precisely disinformation.
MISA Mozambique provide fact-checking service and trained journalists, Nyantumbu says.
There are digital tools that help us to do this, and we at MISA Mozambique have been organizing training for journalism students, for journalists and civil society on how to use these platforms.
As society relies more on social media for information, media advocate says the work of groups like Evidencias and MISA Mozambique will be a powerful tool in accurately and objectively informing the public. Amarilis Gule, VOA Africa, Maputo, Mozambique.
We will have more on our series on the issue of disinformation on the continent all week. Tune in tomorrow. Greek authorities say 23 migrants have been rescued from a dinghy near the island of Lesbos in the eastern Aegean Sea. The Associated Press reports that rescue teams also recovered two bodies after a boat carrying migrants sank off Gavdos over the weekend, bringing the death toll to seven. The government says migrant arrivals have increased by up to 35% in the past year. While most travel the short distance between the Turkish mainland and nearby Greek islands, a larger number now make the perilous 200-mile journey from the Libyan coast to the islands of Crete and Gavdos. U.S. farmers hope President-elect Donald Trump's selection to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture will understand their concerns while guiding trade policy and farm legislation. VOA's Ken Fabo has more from Chicago.
Henry County, Illinois farmer Steve Nightingale and hundreds more from the statewide agricultural community gathered at the Illinois Farm Bureau's annual meeting this month in Chicago to discuss the path forward amid uncertainty about U.S. trade policy.
The farm economy is not great right now. The potential for tariffs, the combination of those two make any decision, gets you a little nervous.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's forecasts for 2024 show farmers across the United States losing nearly a quarter of their net farm income compared to the 2022 peak, while prices for inputs like fertilizer are near all-time highs. Nightingale is concerned about further economic turmoil if social media posts by President-elect Donald Trump outlining tariffs on some U.S. trading partners become policy.
When other countries retaliate against us, they go after the bread and butter, which is agriculture.
Nightingale, the president of the Henry County Farm Bureau, hopes Trump's pick to head the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, understands his concerns about tariffs and the importance of passing a new farm bill to replace one that expired earlier this year.
We were kind of surprised because her name was never on any of the lists that we were seeing.
David Eiserman farms outside Streeter, Illinois, in LaSalle County, one of the top corn and soybean producing counties in the country.
She doesn't really have that background that some of the other ag secretaries have had, but that doesn't mean she'll be a bad one. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Rollins, who served in the previous Trump administration as the acting director of the White House Domestic Policy Council, graduated from Texas A&M University with a degree in agricultural management.
So she's got some ag background, and hopefully she's going to come in with an open mind and be supportive of farmers, and she said she is.
Eiserman is also trying to have an open mind about transforming U.S. trade policy.
And until he takes office, until the new president takes office, we're really not going to know what's going to happen. But I know we've heard he's had talks with Canada, and supposedly those are productive. So maybe it's working in the case of Canada.
I just don't want an agriculture model that's built on government policy.
Dan Miller is the CEO of Steward, which crowdsources investors, connecting them with farmers and other producers. Miller says tariffs may encourage greater diversity in what U.S. farmers grow and where they sell it, shifting from reliance on exporting corn and soybeans to increased production of other crops.
We have a model that's built on huge amount of policy and government support. Most farmers I work with would prefer not to have that. They're just stuck in it. You know, they grow corn and soy because they can drop it at the elevator, get paid.
Miller acknowledges shifting production of any crop is a lengthy, expensive, and complicated process requiring new infrastructure, but hopes debate about tariffs and U.S. agricultural policy allows for policy to shift.
We just want a free market.
While Nightingale wants new buyers for corn and soybean crops, Eiserman would settle for more certainty in U.S. trade and agricultural policy.
We're using us as a pawn, agriculture as a pawn, and that concerns me.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.